Judas and Black Messiah.
Okay.
Now we got another Judas who did the deathbed thing. Are you following the Malcolm X story?
Oh, yes, I did.
Yeah.
I saw that. The one I was telling you about, that the undercover officer that was infiltrating Nation of Islam at the time confessed on his deathbed it was a concerted government activity to murder Malcolm X.
So,
and the family has asked for a full investigation.
Yeah, we've got to have a movie on that one, too.
Yeah.
How about that? It's amazing.
Of course, some of us kind of
had an idea.
You know what I'm saying? I'm just saying.
Yeah. But his story, they put him in jail to protect him, so quote unquote, mm-hmm. make sure. And then, actually, this woman even says there's a rumor about the Judas that he supposedly committed suicide after doing an interview. And there are some people don't necessarily believe that was true either. They didn't want him doing any more talking.
Oh, you're talking about the dude that Will O'Neill.
Yeah, that's the story I hear. She tells it better than I do, so hang around for that.
I will. That's okay.
I mean, when you think about the fact that he did all the stuff, he did the setup, he gave them the blueprint, he lived with it for all that time, and then because the Eyes on the Prize video came out, that's what made him want to kill himself?
Yeah.
That doesn't add up to
No,
me.
I don't think so either. Yeah, he even dosed Fred and Mark Clark. Get a shout out to Mark Clark, too. For being involved in that as well. I've got some TaxCast material. I do this thing from the UK. I don't like to focus on all of the daily events. There's so many weekly events. I'm pretty wrought up by the Biden's first use of his presidential missile attack, and I'm pretty distressed. I haven't heard any discussion of the fact that this is very similar in structure, in a way, to Obama helping Saudis with their Yemen problem, which is kind of a territorial oil problem, if you hear some stories about it. He had to give the Saudis something while he was negotiating the Iran pact with the Europeans and Russia and China. But this idea of attacking on the Syrian border while Biden is meeting with the, well, not Mr. Bonesaw, but the father of Mr. Bonesaw. I haven't heard any discussion of that. And it didn't even come up in the piece that I was going to play today. I'm going to play Stephen Zunes unless I find something better on the subject. Ro Khanna has been tweeting about it. I gather Durbin even said some things about how he was not feeling too well that presidential authority, the War Powers Act, is being snookered again, being elided, ignored. Somewhere I read that, I don't know if this is true, that it only takes one member of the House of Representatives to invoke the War Powers Act. Okay, I was talking to Ammons about this Mr. Soul program that I saw last night. There's actually some interesting material about African-American women artists tonight as well. I'm getting my second jab, so I plan on laying around a lot over the next couple of days. That's my vaccination, as it were. Right after the show, in fact. And I may be representing some of this material tomorrow, depending on how I'm feeling. So I hope you're doing all right. And let's kick it with Mumia Abu-Jamal. He's doing a thing for Cicely Tyson's passing. And apparently this Hazlitt fellow, who was the Mr. Soul, this was a PBS program in the Nixon era. I somehow missed it. I was around at the time, probably not watching a lot of television, but it was taken off the air by machinations from inside the Oval Office. And in fact, the documentary actually shows a conversation of Nixon with two of his advisors saying how we had to do something about Boyers and those blacks on PBS. something to that effect. Check it out. It's going to be rebroadcast in the overnight if you can record it, or you can probably get it through your passport. Well, that's enough falderal. Here's Mumia talking about a great woman artist. And Amy Goodman's got something on the virus. I'm going to deprecate her a little bit, I'm afraid, today. Oh, well. What can you do?
Madam Cecily Tyson. From the Negro stage to the glittering lights of film, the long career of Cecily Tyson radiated through lifetimes. On December 19th, 1924, Cecily Tyson was born in East Harlem, and despite her religious mother's opposition, she was drawn to the stage. Despite dozens of films, TV roles, and performances on the live stage, she refused to portray her people in a less than dignified light. For this, she doubtless lost and wasn't offered a number of roles. But like her colleagues, the late Ossie Davis and Ruby Dee, one would be hard-pressed to find a shameful performance. In 1972, Tyson received an Oscar nomination for Best Actress for her performance in the movie Sounder, opposite Paul Winfield, for her portrayal of a wife and mother of a Louisiana sharecropper family. 2 years later, she would dazzle audiences in the CBS miniseries, The Autobiography of Miss Jane Pittman, where she played a woman over 100 years old who lived to see the rise of the civil rights movement. Funny thing, though, the real Cecily Tyson lived to be 96 years old, and still she radiated vitality and beauty. For almost a decade, Tyson was married to the jazz master and genius Miles Davis. In her later years, she appeared in many movies made by Tyler Perry, in which she played the elder female wisdom figure. She inspired generations of actors and taught through her life work what it meant to demand respect. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
Vaccine apartheid. If one person is unprotected, we are all unprotected. I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! With Dennis Moynihan and our weekly Breaking the Sound Barrier podcast. I've personally received more doses of a COVID-19 vaccine than 130 countries. Those are the words of Dr. Craig Spencer, talking about the two vaccine shots he recently got as an emergency room doctor. Back in 2014, he contracted Ebola while combating the epidemic in Guinea, Africa. Dr. Spencer knows the value of public health protocols, personal protective equipment, or PPE, and vaccinations.
Just a few weeks ago, you know, we're the only country in sub-Saharan Africa, one of the only countries in sub-Saharan Africa to get vaccinated was in Guinea, and they received 25 doses, not 2,500, not 25,000, but 25.
Dr. Spencer is director of Global Health and Emergency Medicine at Columbia University, speaking on the Democracy Now! NewsHour.
I've been vaccinated, thankfully, but my friends who work in a clinic in southern Burundi in East Africa may have to wait until 2022 or 2023.
The problem Dr. Spencer speaks of so personally has been described as vaccine apartheid, or vaccine nationalism. Wealthy nations like the United States, the United Kingdom, and European Union countries contracted to buy billions of doses of prospective vaccines while they were still in development. Poorer nations, where 85% of the world's population lives, are left scrambling, forced to wait for vaccine shipments from COVAX, the global cooperative vaccination facility coordinated by the World Health Organization. Dr. Spencer notes that some rich countries have even bought up enough doses to vaccinate their population several times over.
We can hold on to them and hoard them, or we can think about how we get other vulnerable populations around the world vaccinated. There are 59 million healthcare workers in the world. We could take a very small proportion of the doses that we have ordered, and we could help the coordinated program with the World Health Organization, with other international health bodies, to get those most vulnerable people in the world vaccinated so that not only are we safe here at home, but others are safe everywhere else.
A key impediment to the mass vaccination of the global population is a supply shortage precipitated by greed. Most of the available vaccines have been developed by private for-profit pharmaceutical corporations that hold patents on the vaccines, granting them monopoly control over the production of these life-saving drugs. They're guaranteed massive profits despite having received, in some cases, billions of dollars in public subsidies for vaccine development. This exploitation of the pandemic for profit is only possible with strictly enforced global treaties, primarily the World Trade Organization's TRIPS. That's trade-related aspects of intellectual property rights. India and South Africa are leading an effort for a temporary waiver of these WTO patent protections, which would allow private and public facilities around the world to mass-produce vaccines and other related patent-protected items like syringes and PPE. The United States, first under former President Donald Trump, but continuing under President Joe Biden, along with a handful of wealthy countries, have been blocking the waiver. A growing movement coordinated by the group Public Citizen is pressuring Biden to reverse this destructive policy.
It would make all the difference in the world.
That's Democratic Congressmember Jan Schakowsky of Illinois speaking on Democracy Now!
We're spending additional billions of dollars to address tourism, to help the airlines, to be able to help our economy. All of that will be for naught if we cannot protect ourselves against this virus, because we will not help the international community. And there are hundreds of organizations, health organizations, human rights organizations, NGOs around the world that are pleading really for this waiver to be approved. I know that Nancy Pelosi, our Speaker of the House, has spoken out on this issue as well and says that this is important for us to do for ourselves. It's our own self-interest as well.
Congressmember Schakowsky's point is vital. If one person in the world remains unprotected, we are all unprotected. The COVID-19 virus mutates rapidly. Highly contagious variants are spreading around the globe, including the UK, South Africa, and Brazil variants, now joined by the New York City variant. If the virus is not contained globally, it will continue to mutate and spread through unprotected populations, potentially rendering our current crop of vaccines ineffective, plunging the planet back into a catastrophic pandemic all over again. Fatima Hassan knows what the term apartheid means. She's a South African human rights campaigner who fought for access to life-saving HIV/AIDS drugs for poor countries. She wrote an article in this week's Foreign Policy. She writes, "A pernicious form of vaccine apartheid has emerged, largely based on wealth and geography." She goes on, "The pandemic response should not have to rely on voluntary cooperation, but urgent wartime measures, including compulsory ones," she says. The WTO is meeting in early March to debate the waiver. As it relies on consensus decision-making, any single country can block it. Trillions of dollars in potential economic damage and millions of lives hang in the balance. The United States, the wealthiest nation in the world, with the highest number of COVID-19 deaths, now over 500,000, should be leading the charge to share life-saving vaccines and treatments around the globe. I'm Amy Goodman with Dennis Moynihan.
Okay, I promised I was going to make a supportive critique of Amy Goodman, and I'm going to do that now. It's uncomfortable, but the headline she read just yesterday, I believe, from Rokana was this: "The administration should have sought congressional authorization here. We need to work to extricate from the Middle East, not escalate." That's only a third of the tweet. The first sentence, which wasn't on the broadcast, was, "We cannot stand up for congressional authorization before military strikes, only when there is a Republican president," and then called for congressional authorization. So I tweeted her about it, and I said I was disappointed, and I expect her to have Ro Khan on and maybe some other people. Senator from Connecticut, and I thought I heard Durbin say something about, but I can't find it with a Google News search, so maybe that was a dream. As I say, I think one dimension that I haven't heard anywhere, I'll have to ask Gareth Porter, that this is some kind of message while dissing MBS, Mr. Bonesaw, and talking to the elder who's about to die.
he can say, well, we got your backs against those people on the Syrian border. All right, and I'll probably play Steven Zunas on it. Met him and argue with him from time to time about subtleties. He's the Middle East scholar, though. So, but there's a book called The Devil's Game, and I'm forgetting the author's name, but it talks about how U.S. policy was always to back fundamentalists if you could use them to undermine economic and other kinds of nationalists in not just the Arab world, but particularly the Arab world. On this TRIPS business, what was referred to there, I'm looking for something to sign, a petition. I guess I'll just email the White House and say, why are you not allowing the TRIPS to be suspended so that these vaccines can be made anywhere with the capacity to make them and actually help them make them. Apparently the Sputnik V, the Russians are exporting it, and they're also helping build factories in countries around the world to make their own vaccines. They probably get a share, I guess. Everybody does, right? And it's called vaccine diplomacy, and it's seen as a negative by the Beltway bandits or pundits. All right. I want to get some of this on. I guess I'll go to what I was talking about with the Ammons, which is this piece with the advisor to the filmmakers of the Judas and the Black Messiah right here in Chicagoland, Fred Hampton's murder. He was seen as a threat because he was broadening the base of across all colors and stratas in Chicago. And there was a sympathetic sort of Appalachian contingent that was talking to him about doing community organizing. So that was seen as a threat. All right, let's see. Enough of this, all right, and let's get to it. Sonali Kalhatar. She has a great interview with Dean Baker about the TRIPS issue, which you can also find at the Transnational Institute. I didn't say anything about that outfit. It's like the IPS, only in Amsterdam. The tax cast that'll be going on after this is with a scholar who affiliates with the TNI. Dean Baker has a great interview with that outfit, too. You can find that.
KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. A new film by Warner Brothers, directed by Shaka King, produced by Ryan Coogler, covers the rise and untimely death of Fred Hampton, chairman of the Chicago Black Panther Party. Judas and the Black Messiah is a necessary telling of the ways in which the U.S. government ruthlessly crushed movements for black liberation through the use of informants, infiltration, violence, and murder. The nuanced portrait of Fred Hampton, a charismatic and revolutionary leader played in the film by actor Daniel Kaluuya, is set against the character of FBI informant William O'Neill, played by actor Lakeith Stanfield. Judas and the Black Messiah is out now on HBO Max, and joining us to discuss the film is Rosa Clemente, journalist, producer, political commentator, and scholar activist. She's one of the associate producers for the film and also served as historical consultant. She's also the executive director of the Black Latino Latina Organizing Project and is currently completing her PhD at the W.E.B. Du Bois Center at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. She's a frequent guest on our program. Welcome back, Rosa.
Thank you for having me, Sonali.
So this film was several years in the making. I understand that you've been consulting for it for about 3 years. Unfortunately, most Americans, especially young people, haven't heard of Fred Hampton. Fred Hampton, of course, this very important figure in Chicago politics, but also nationwide. How do you describe who he was?
Fred Hampton was 21 years old when he was assassinated by the FBI, the Chicago police, and other law enforcement and state agencies in this country. Chairman Fred started organizing when he was 14 in the NAACP. This movie shows the last 16 months of his life, and definitely shows once he created the Rainbow Coalition, which he created, not Jesse Jackson, that included the Young Lords, the American Indian Movement, the White Patriots, and other forces that were economically oppressed, is when he became dangerous. I mean, we could say, we use the word multiracial organizing. Chairman Fred was doing that before it even had a name to it. And that we always have to remember also that Deputy Mark Clark lost his life in that assassination, that his partner and also Black Panther, Okun Jerry, was 8.5 months pregnant with his son. And there were other Panthers in that house that survived. So, you know, I think it's important for people to realize too that the Black Panther Party believed in self-defense, and also we're really a socialist organization. That gets lost in a lot of, even throughout Black studies, you know, to talk about that he viewed, as he was right, American imperialism and capitalism as the main things that were keeping people oppressed, but that he also worked with a lot of street organizations and brought them together. When he met Chacha Jimenez, who was in Chicago, was part of a street organization called the Young Lords. And after Chacha met Chairman Fred, Chacha formed the street organization into what we know today as the Young Lords Party.
The film does focus on the capitalist critique that Fred Hampton espoused, and the eloquent ways in which he talked about it. It showcased the free breakfast program that the Black Panthers organized in Chicago, the medical clinic they wanted to open, which is quite unusual for a film that's been put out in a mainstream platform to address. Tell me about the making of this film, the people that were responsible for it, how it is through and through, even though it's a Warner Brothers release. This is a film made by African Americans, by Black Americans, for America, and it's unusual for that in Hollywood, unfortunately.
Yeah, this week made 3 years since Chaka Khan, who is the co-writer along with Will Burson, but the director of the movie, reached out to me. We were in similar artists and organizing circles, and he asked me if I still, or I was in contact with Chairman Fred Hampton Jr., and I said, yeah,
And this is, of course, Fred Hampton's son, who's still active and a leader in Chicago?
Yeah, and was born 25 days after the December 4th massacre. He was born on December 29th, 1969. And I said, yeah. And I did tell Chaka right away, a lot of people have tried to make this movie. It's going to require an immense amount of trust and building, not only with Chairman Fred Jr., but also Mother Comrade Okun and Jerry, Black Panther elders that are still alive, the family of Black Panthers. You know, it was a lot, because a lot of other Hollywood forces had tried to make this movie. So, you know, I think my most important role was connecting them together. And then about 2 or 3 months after the initial call from Chaka, we were in Chicago along with Ryan Coogler, his producing partner, and his partner, Cindy Coogler, as well as Charles King. You know, Charles King has really been right now one of the few, if not only few, Black executives in Hollywood that are co-producing and also monetarily giving money to these movies that have to be made. You know, Chaka has been very clear that other movies, first, other studios were not even trying to hear the pitch. Second, that Warner Brothers at the beginning was not putting, you know, up the money that they needed to make this film, just the quality of it and the reach that it would have as well, pre the movie and post the movie. And Charles King was instrumental in that, you know. So how does this movie get made? You know, it got made because we also, Ryan Coogler directed Black Panther, and this is Ryan's next film, you know. And I think there's something to be said about the superhero Black Panther, but the real ones that are still alive, or their children that are still alive and still have to deal with the legacy of what happened to their parents, whether those parents were assassinated, incarcerated, or are still alive, you know. So it definitely came down to trust, and Chaka being very clear on what he was going to do with this movie and what he was not going to accept from the studio system in Hollywood.
Let's watch a part of the trailer of the film Judas and the Black Messiah.
I want to share something with you. Like the masses, I was in awe when I first laid eyes on all the things you are. I heard that speech. I knew we make noise. I just thought it'd be in the streets.
The Black Panthers are the single greatest threat to our national security. Our counterintelligence program must prevent the rise of a Black Messiah.
You're looking at 18 months for the stolen car, 5 years for impersonating a federal officer, or you can go home.
What do you want?
Get close to Hampton.
The Black Panthers are forming a rainbow coalition of oppressed brothers and sisters of every color.
Neutralize him by any means necessary.
America's on fire right now. And until that fire is extinguished, nothing else means a damn thing. Imagine what we could accomplish together. We can heal this whole city.
You ain't telling me it was gonna be like this. This ain't no terror.
And that is part of the trailer of the new film, Judas and the Black Messiah. My guest, Rosa Clemente, was one of the associate producers on the film. Rosa, the film focuses on not just Fred Hampton, who is, of course, the main protagonist, but the FBI informant. It opens with the story of William O'Neill, a car thief, who was basically pressured into becoming an infiltrator into the Black Panther Party rather than serve time in prison. Why do you think the film focused on this aspect of history?
Yeah, and again, Shaka has talked about this through this whole process. And I agree. I don't think that William O'Neill is as much the focus as it shows that all of our movements were infiltrated a lot from the beginning. And that obviously William O'Neill suffered with the choices he made, you know, and there's definitely been a lot of critique from certain circles about humanizing or how people feel he was humanized, you know, and I think we always have to keep our mind on the bigger picture, you know. What he did was wrong. In our circles, we call that snitching. Like, you're not supposed to be able to come back from that. He struggled with his demons, but also that the state went after him as well. You know, he had committed what we would consider petty theft. And, you know, they found an opportunity to stop the rise of the Black Panther Party. And although Chairman Fred was the leader of the Illinois chapter at that point, we all know that the Black Panther Party was flourishing, especially post the assassination of Dr. King in 1968. You know, so I think everybody looks at it a little bit differently. I tell people this is a movie. It's not a biopic. It's not a documentary. It shouldn't have taken 50 years not to only talk about Chairman Fred in this mainstream light, but to talk about all the young people. And that all these people were incredibly young. I mean, for the government to come up with a plan to assassinate a 21-year-old and also assassinate his wife, I mean, his partner at that time. Like, Aku and Jerry was not supposed to survive that shootout and certainly not supposed to have given birth. And I do want to shout out Dominique Fishback because she is the main woman in the movie.
Right, the film doesn't just focus on the two men, Fred Hampton and William O'Neill. It's also a love story between then Deborah Johnson, she's now Kua and Jerry, and Chairman Fred.
Yeah, I mean, to me, that was really important, seeing that play out, seeing Mother Kua meet Dominique and meet Daniel and ask them at a meeting, like, why do you want to do this? What research have you done? And in fact, Dominique, there's a beautiful moment where she reads a poem and her character reads a poem to Chairman Fred. And Dominique, the actor is very young from East New York in Brooklyn. Wrote the poem herself and asked Shaka, like, wow. I want to write the poem. And, you know, are you willing to add this? And Shaka collaboratively said, yeah. And I think it is important to show love, you know, whether it's romantic love or love for comrades, that a lot of times we don't get to see that. And in fact, one interview that Akua did, she says, you know, I didn't think about it, but watching it on screen, I do go back to that time where we were also immensely in love with each other. And we're fighting together as revolutionaries and comrades.
The term Black Messiah comes from J. Edgar Hoover, who never actually meets most of the characters in the film. He's shown as this kind of separate but overarching pressure. You know, the head of the FBI who was responsible for these campaigns of terror, played beautifully, I should say, by Martin Sheen in the film. How important is it to remember that history, that it was that vision of J. Edgar Hoover that played out in the most bloody of ways across the country in Black communities?
It is extremely important, and that's why we can use this as a tool to teach younger people about the counterintelligence program. Although it did focus on the Black Panther Party for self-defense, and secondly, then focus on Puerto Rican independistas to crush them by any means necessary, that J. Edgar Hoover started this in his spying and his going after particularly African-American and, at that time, Cuban, Puerto Rican, Mexican activists, comrades, and organizers, that he began that in 1955. You know, he went after Dr. King and he went after Malcolm X and he went after people like John Lennon and Billie Holiday and so many artists as well. And it's critically important because, unfortunately, our movements at this moment are infiltrated. We might not know who the infiltrator is right now. Some of us may know who they are, but it's only because the Weather Underground stole those documents in Philadelphia in the 70s that really exposed what all of them already knew, that they were infiltrators, there were people there to disrupt and sow discord, but also someone like William O'Neill gave the apartment, the way the apartment was laid out. William O'Neill did that, and he gave it to the FBI and the Chicago police, and that's why when they went up in there, they knew exactly where Fred would be and Deputy Mark Clark. You know, so
William O'Neill, just to remind our audience, is the person who infiltrated the Black Panther Party for the FBI, played in the film Judas and the Black Messiah by Lakeith Stanfield, who I should say just gives an absolutely incredible performance.
He struggled with that. He talked about it. You know, he thought he was going to play Chairman Fred. That's the part he wanted to play. Huh. He ended up playing William O'Neill. And he's talked about that post production of the film, which wrapped up actually before all these protests this summer. So in a way, it worked out when it came out because production wrapped up in October 2019. But Lakeith has spoken about needing to go to therapy, you know, and to see Daniel, Dominique, and everybody who played, they were very serious about their research. I mean, a lot of them spent a year just reading up on the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense and having conversations with other people, particularly elders. But, you know, yeah, he struggled with it. He says to this day that he struggled with that. Just like William O'Neill gave his last interview for the Eyes on the Prize documentary series, part two. And later on that night, some people say he walked in front of a bus and committed suicide. Some people say that after he gave that interview, the FBI and other forces knew that they couldn't let him live because he would spill even more about what they did. You know, so obviously he struggled with that until the day he died.
And the film shows actual clips of the real William O'Neill speaking about, from that Eyes on the Prize Part 2 that aired on PBS, speaking about the role that he played. And you can see the struggle even in his mind. Let's go back to Fred Hampton, and in particular now his son, Fred Hampton Jr., who Kua Njeri was pregnant with when Fred Hampton was murdered by the state. How is Fred Hampton Jr. carrying on his father's legacy today in a way that links to contemporary movements for racial justice, the Black Lives Matter movement, social justice, economic justice?
You know, Fred has been carrying that work since he was born, before he even understood that. There's something that Fred always says that strikes me. He said, the first time I felt the cold, hard steel of a gun was when I was in my mother's womb. You know, and he's lived that for over 50 years, and he has called it a blessing and a burden. Well, from what I have known of Chairman Fred for over 20 years of knowing him, is that he is 100% committed to the struggle, the revolutionary struggle, even if it puts him on odds with other Black and brown folks. He was very clear that the house that he now lives in with Mother Comrade Akua needed to be saved because that's the house that his father grew up in. And one of the most important things about the movie is because of the movie, the house was finally saved from foreclosure tax. Oh, wow. Citations, including many citations from the Chicago police, and it will be turned into a museum and community center, and hopefully as well get landmark status, which puts it on the registry for the national parks. And anybody who's traveled or knows the national park system, that's where we see a lot of our history at these homes, you know. So for all the some of the critiques, which I had to kind of just spend last 2 weeks, like read all the good stuff, I tell people that house is saved. It could have been demolished because they are trying to demolish homes of so many of our ancestors. And I was clear that one of the things my role in that was to make sure that that happened by just making sure that people knew that this house existed and that it needed to be saved. And that happened last Thursday. So it was
wow.
Phenomenal.
So very recently. Well, finally, Rosa, the main message from this film was, or one of the central messages was the ruthless violence from the government. You know, the Black Panther Party, like Malcolm X and many other Black revolutionaries, have been painted as controversial and violent figures in our history, but it was the government violence that far overshadowed any mentions of violent reactions from actual human beings. But the government violence and the brutal, basically mass killing that took place at the hands of law enforcement, state and local, state and federal and local. Was there ever justice for those murders?
No, I mean, we still have political prisoners and prisoners of war in these prison systems, including Sundiata Okoli, who's 80, survived COVID, survived cancer, and is still incarcerated. Mm-hmm. And we saw Jalil Muntikin recently be released. And within a month, Rochester police arrested him for making a mistake on his DMV identification form. So, like, you know, the government never forgets, and they continue to come after people even two or three generations behind.
Well, Rosa, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. The film, again, is out on HBO Max. It's called, of course, Judas and the Black Messiah. It's been very well reviewed. Thank you so much for joining us, Rosa. Thank you, Sonali. Thanks for having me. My guest has been Rosa Clemente, journalist, producer, political commentator, scholar, activist. We've been talking about Judas and the Black Messiah, the film that she's one of the associate producers for. I'm Sonali Kohatkarwa, online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RU with Sonali.
Okay, that was shorter than I have on my screen here, so that's good. Rising Up with Sonali, as you say, she's very much all over the place. You can find her. She's oh so social. Something completely different now. I like to get back to economics, and there's a feature out of the Tax Justice Network in the UK. They have an advisor, James Henry, who is in New York City, I believe. Maybe he teaches at Boston. I can't remember. James Henry is an advisor. Textjustice.net now, not .uk anymore. They've been doing an ongoing thing about, tax justice. And one of the things they've been highlighting is this transaction tax. Some people call it the Tobin tax because it was actually a rather conservative University of Chicago scholar who came up with it. He was thinking mainly in terms of not raising revenue, but slowing down transactions, because he thought even in decades ago they were going too fast, and now they're electronic, and one of the competitive advantages in New York City is having your fiber optic shorter than somebody else's, so go figure. Innovation. That's palpable cynicism if it didn't get through the mask. And labor hours coming up. I just texted Bob Polinsky if he wanted me to foreshadow anything they're doing today. I think Stefan will be on board. She's doing this labor history project that she may speak about. I hope so, because I want to listen to it. I've been seeing something. Oh, okay, well, I can say they're going to feature some music from the Stylistics, which gives me an opportunity to mention Mr. Soul, this documentary about the program called Soul in seminal stuff. Amazing. James Baldwin was on it. Nikki Giovanni went over to London to interview James Baldwin for the show. Archival footage. It was on last night, and I happened to catch it. It's on in an overnight segment as a rebroadcast. And if you're a member of WLL Passport, you can probably see it anytime. Help support community media. All right, here's the TaxCast Naomi Fowler. I've cut off some of the intro. They do first a kind of a review of something you've heard a little bit about, but this is a view from the UK, which is the whole gaming the stock market system. He had an expression, this John Christensen's fellow had an expression, about we need to chuck the entire stock system. I forget. Shareholder stock system. I thought that was a great turn of phrase. He doesn't use it in this one, but... and then they get to this interview, in-depth interview, with a 10-point plan. Maybe we won't get all 10 on, but it's the Transnational Institute, which is international, but I think it's based primarily in Amsterdam. It'd be great for a transnational institute to be looking at global problems, and he has some global solutions, and there's a lot of information about the U.S. in it. He has a new figure on stock ownership that is pretty astonishing. It already was pretty lopsided. It's gotten more so. Here's Naomi. You can find her on Twitter.
Campaigning, they're putting a tax transparency law for corporations, country by country reporting, to a vote in the Council of Ministers. It makes it easier for us to know basically where companies should actually be paying their taxes. Germany's been a key blocker on this, but the vote's now going ahead. The corporate lobbies have managed to include plenty of loopholes though, so it's not perfect, but it's a step forward. And secondly, incredible news, what the Tax Justice Network calls an outright global triumph for the advocacy efforts of the tax justice movement. The United Nations Financial Accountability, Transparency and Integrity Panel has called for a UN tax convention. It's also backed our ABCs of tax justice solutions. So that's automatic multilateral exchange of information, beneficial ownership registers, those are public registers of the real owners of companies, and country by country reporting for corporations. The heat is now on to move rulemaking on tax from the rich country club of the OECD to the UN, as we've called for many years. And finally, the tax justice movement has been nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize. The Global Alliance for Tax Justice has been nominated jointly with our friends at the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists. Great stuff. Okay, we're going to speak to John Christensen now for his take on this month. We recorded this just yesterday about the crazy GameStop frenzy. And since then, the GameStop share price is soaring again. Madness. Okay, John, we've had a great demonstration of everything that's wrong with our economies and why they're not really going anywhere with this GameStop saga. And it shows yet again, doesn't it, why we so desperately need financial transactions taxes to discourage stock exchange casino business, which has nothing to do with real investment or the real economy. So GameStop is an ailing video game seller. The whole thing was spun as the valiant little guy supposedly championing the stock market by sabotaging a series of Wall Street hedge funds by revenge buying this GameStop stock. Without going too far down the rabbit hole of speculative trading, what actually did happen there, John?
A good question. For those not familiar with North American shopping malls, GameStop is a retail business specializing in video games and games consoles and related electronics, much of which nowadays is bought online. Even before the pandemic, the company's turnover was being impacted by online sales. And more closures since the pandemic started have merely accelerated that trend towards buying online. So some analysts working for hedge funds, which specialize in a process known as shorting, realized that GameStop shares were considerably overvalued, and they had been trading in single figures in 2019 and early 2020. And so these analysts thought they could profit from the situation by taking a bet that the share price would go down. Now, normally when they do this, they simply borrow shares from a stockbroker, they sell the shares at the current high price, watch the share price plummet, buy back at that lower price, and return the borrowed stock to the stockbroker, pocketing vast profits which they've made. But that's not how it worked with GameStop. In late autumn 2020, the hedgies moved in to start shorting the GameStop shares. But some investors noted the shares were being shorted, and they saw an opportunity to do what's called a short squeeze. So using social media, including YouTube and Reddit, they put out a whole load of promotional materials boosting GameStop's prospects. Now, loads of individual investors and quite a few institutional investors as well saw an opportunity to sting the shorters. So they bought into the stock, watching the share price rise from about $20 a piece at the beginning of January to close to $500 at one stage in January 2021. At the moment of peak frenzy in January, GameStop shares were trading at $483, which is 24 times the trading price at the start of that month. In January, the buying was so frantic that a major retail share trading app, which is known as Robinhood, widely used by individual investors because it provides its services for free, Robinhood had to block customers from buying GameStop shares, claiming that they simply didn't have enough liquidity to handle the volume of share trading at such a high price level.
Right, and I believe when Robinhood wanted to recapitalize, where did they get that from? They got it from the big banks.
Yes, they very quickly borrowed a few extra $1 billion to get the buying up and running again, but not before loud complaints came from investors shouting that they were being excluded from the feeding frenzy. Now, several things happened during the course of those two crazy weeks in January. First, the hedge funds, which originally set out to short GameStop shares, found that the share price went up rather than down. And the more the share price rose, the more they stood to lose. And some funds, like Melvin Capital, have taken a spectacular hit running to billions of dollars. Second, while some of the retail investors who bought in early to the short squeeze, they made a whole bunch of money and sold out before the bubble peaked. But then a lot of other people got the timing wrong. They saw the share price surging, they borrowed money to buy the whatever shares they could lay their hands on, and then they watched the share price tumble, leaving them holding shares which couldn't be sold for love nor money. These people have lost a lot of money from gambling at the very peak of a bubble. They should have known better, but greed and herd instinct took over. For what it's worth, GameStop shares were trading at $40 this morning when I looked at the market price. So if you bought shares at the peak price in January, you're currently facing a loss of over 90% of your investment.
Right. Yeah. So I should preface my next question with the knowledge that, you know, when you go into the casino always wins. And this idea that we can all become kind of miniature financiers is really an illusion. And whilst there may have been a blip where a few small people got to play with the big boys, and it nearly all is boys, who are the real winners and the losers in this scenario? There were lots of fairly big hedge funds and banks that also benefited from this whole frenzy. Let's talk about the heroes and the villains of this piece.
Look, we have villains aplenty, but I don't see any heroes in this story. Now, some commentators have tried to spin this as a story of common Joe, and you're right, it's mainly men, up against the machine. So ordinary investors taking on the hedge fund billionaires. But that is way, way too starry-eyed. It's much more accurate to talk about one kind of gambler taking on another kind of gambler, with the banks lending money to everyone as they took their seats at the gambling table. And that's what happened. Now, one of the interesting things about GameStop is how stock market influencers used social media to persuade investors that there was money to be made from squeezing the short positions of the big bad hedge funds. Now, some people, including some prominent politicians, have claimed that internet posts were being used to manipulate the GameStop share price in what's called a pump and dump scheme. In other words, you pump the price up and then you dump them as soon as you see quick killings to be made. But this kind of manipulation is very hard to prove in a court of law. And the online boosters, and there were plenty of them, they can always claim that they were just exercising their right to free speech. This is the way the markets work. There may well be an inquiry or even multiple inquiries into what actually happened during those weeks of frenzied trading, but I'm not expecting that anyone will be found guilty of market manipulation. Those hedgies love to talk about the markets as a jungle, so it's a bit rich for them to complain when the junior predators bite back. But it's equally rich for the small-scale gamblers, investors, to moan about not getting their fair share of the pickings from the GameStop carcass.
It sort of seems to be the casino winning again and again and again, despite some of these smaller people getting together in this way. But what does all this tell us about contemporary capitalism and how we fix that?
Now, in theory, stock markets should lead to optimal allocation of investment. Investors should identify viable companies producing useful goods and useful services, and their investments should support company directors with building the company and producing those goods and services. But in the same way that Bitcoin has surged in price, it was about $30,000 a month ago per Bitcoin. Now it's just shy of $50,000 today. The GameStop bubble has no rooting in any kind of economic reality. And this especially applies to the day trading community who piled into the GameStop share trading frenzy. They're making speculative short-term trades. Now, the British economist, Professor Susan Strange, gave this kind of capitalism a name. She called it casino capitalism. And her book on that subject is probably one of the most important economic books of the late 20th century. One reform which really might help to discourage these kind of trading frenzies is currently being considered by the New York State Assembly. That's a proposal which was filed this week to reinstate a provision for a stock transfer tax. And it's interesting that senior officials in the Biden administration are showing interest not just in the stock transfer tax, but more generally in financial transaction taxes. And I think that's encouraging.
Yeah, it's a hugely under-taxed area. And there's a need, isn't there, to reclaim the word investment, because real investment, if we have a think about it, would I rather my pension was invested long term into a cooperative, a care home run by nurses, or a renewable energy company owned by its staff? No shares, no huge CEO bonuses, no private equity involved, long term decision making, innovation and all of that? Or would I rather my pension flies from the seat of its pants on split second trading of the kind that we see every day?
Yeah, that's a very interesting and important point you make there about investment, the word investment. As you say, so much of what they call investment is just speculation. But perhaps importantly, such a huge proportion of the cross-border investment is not being made into new productive activities. It's going into mergers and acquisitions, which are leading to market concentration, concentrations of power and monopolies. And that's not at all good for an economy. Or it's going into real estate, or not into productive activity. So the term investment is very widely used and abused by politicians and by journalists, and we need to think much more carefully about what kind of policies would serve best to restore investment or to push investment into a productive economy rather than into the kind of extractive economy that I think typifies Wall Street and the City of London and some of the other big financial centres in the modern economy and in contemporary capitalism more generally.
Yeah, and there's another thing that can be done, which is to restrict how quickly shares change hands.
Yes, absolutely. The average period of holding shares has fallen dramatically in the last 40 years, and perhaps there needs to be a recognition that shares should be held for a minimum period, maybe a few months, before they earn dividends and so on, because this type of short-term speculative trading doesn't help company directors to invest for the long term. It has created a very short-term attitude in most of the major financial markets. This is extremely unhelpful, particularly at the moment when we need to see huge investment directed towards a new energy-efficient, non-fossil fuel market. There's a huge transition facing humanity, and at the moment I don't think markets are in any way geared to making that kind of transition.
Thanks, John. And yes, we're on the cusp of major transition, and we can't dodge the hard choices anymore. Climate change is already hurting people in many parts of the world, and now the pandemic is hitting everyone at the moment. In history, we've seen how huge change can come after catastrophe. I've got Ben Tippett of the fantastic Transnational Institute with me today. He says we can fix it. He's written a report called Paying for the Pandemic and a Just Transition. Welcome, Ben.
Fantastic. Yeah, thanks, Naomi, for inviting me on the podcast. I love the podcast and also the work of Tax Justice Network. I use quite a lot of your research in the report, and I'd really recommend anyone go and see what you're doing there if you want any understanding of what's going on in global finance and global economics.
Thanks. So, Ben, you've calculated that the world needs $9 trillion in spending, and your report tells us exactly how the world can raise that $9 trillion. You make the really important point right at the beginning of your report that even the IMF now agrees that rich governments who control their own currency can increase spending. And you describe that as a welcome departure from the false austerity narrative of the past 10 years, that the books always need to be balanced. So really the point is that the onus is on rich governments to spend whatever is needed today. And it's really important, I think, before we talk about your solutions, that we so need to tackle this scarcity argument that's such a strong narrative internalized by so many people. We do have the resources to solve the world's challenges and the global south's challenges at the same time. So because of that ability by wealthy countries with strong currencies to create money, some of the solutions we're going to talk about must involve wealth transfers, or you could say investments, really, from the global north. And these are investments in all our futures, in all our interests.
Yeah, we need to make those who have the most economic ability pay for this crisis, because they are the ones who are able to bear the costs without violating their fundamental human or economic rights. And actually, in some cases, we find that those with the greatest ability to pay are themselves the ones who are most responsible for these crises. So the aim of the report really is to say, we can do this. You know, there are solutions.
And you make the point as well that we don't need to worry so much about the COVID debts wealthy governments are running up at the moment.
Yeah, interest rates are at a historically low level. You know, interest rates are themselves decided upon by governments and central banks, well, by central banks in particular. So it's not that they suddenly drop out of the sky. The government can have smaller repayments when interest rates are historically lower. And this is, as you say, a very welcome departure from the austerity narrative. That said, we do still need to be thinking about taxation and redistributed policies at a global level. And that's partly because this idea of printing more money and going into more debt is really just a solution for governments in the global north.
Yes, exactly. And if you take the UK, for example, we basically owe ourselves the money. And you have to bear in mind all this is about investments. It's not just spending. But for nations that are hamstrung by debt and don't have strong currencies, yeah, it's not an option. And your report looks at how those things can be overcome. It's shocking that 64 countries are paying more on servicing debt than they are on healthcare.
Yeah, there's a ensuing debt crisis in the global south. It's to do with the fact that we need taxation policies to tackle inequality, militarism, and climate change. COVID has opened up an opportunity to shape the economic discourse, you know, to say the next 20 years could be one in which we rebuild a more just global economic system, given the amount of suffering that people have had to go through over the last few years and before.
Yes, and that reminds me of what they call the spirit of 1945 in Europe, when people who suffered so much during the Second World War and sacrificed such a lot demanded genuine deep change. I mean, in the UK, we eventually got the welfare state and the National Health Service, things like that. So, okay, you've estimated in your report that over the next decade, the world needs $9 trillion every year to settle the costs of the pandemic, tackle the climate crisis, and make sure that people everywhere have basic human rights. So things like being able to go to a doctor or a hospital, having drinkable water and education, not going hungry. And you have two branches to your report. You've got solutions, which we're going to talk about in a minute, and you identify six spending needs for the world. I prefer to call them investments.
Definitely. Yeah, I think that's a good place to start. And actually, it's interesting you say you prefer investments. Maybe investments captures more of the building aspect of this and the opening up of new opportunities. So yeah, there's six basic costs and investments: the problems of the pandemic, of climate change, of the sustainable development goals, climate reparations, and reparations for slavery. So the estimations for these generally come from the UN, the OECD, from the IMF. They tend to be quite mainstream institutions.
Right. Tot all that up and you end up with $9 trillion worth of spending or investment that we need each year over the next 10 years to get the world out of the severe trouble that it's in. So let's just look at one of those before we talk about how we can fix all these. Let's look at the climate investments we need to make. Just to stand still in the global south, you say $300 billion a year is needed in climate reparations, and that's just to pay for the loss and damages of climate change there.
You know, many countries in the global south are suffering irreversible losses and costly damages from droughts, floods, typhoons, all of these kind of severe weather events. One of the estimates for how much these countries are losing in loss and damages is roughly around $300 billion per year. And this is something that could be paid in a form of a climate reparation from the global north to the global south to deal with those loss and damages. You might be thinking, but don't the global north also suffer from loss and damages from climate change? They do, but really the global south suffers apparently more than 90% of the costs and also 98% of the deaths associated with climate change.
Right. And then you've estimated there's a $3 trillion bill for fixing the climate crisis globally.
Yeah. Just so we have like a ballpark of how much money we're talking about here. So according to the UN, the World Bank and the International Governmental Panel on Climate Change, we're going to need roughly $3 trillion per year to decarbonize the global economy and fight climate change. So what's that money going to be spent on? It's going to be on things like decarbonizing energy production, manufacturing processes, transportation, all of this kind of stuff. Within that, though, we also need to think about the historic inequities and the historic injustice that is really embedded within climate change.
Okay, it's good to understand the scale of the investments that are needed. Let's have the good news then on how we can get those resources and why we know it absolutely can be done. Your 10 proposals. So number one on your list is global wealth taxes. That you estimate could raise over $4 trillion a year, which is really incredible.
Yeah, of course. So this is, I guess, the big headline proposal. You know, it's the most revenue generating proposal. If you're in the top 0.01% of the global wealth distribution, you pay an effective tax rate of 10%. But actually that in and of itself would also be spread out so that people at the top would be paid much higher amounts. It's effectively, in a way, a proposal that would provide a kind of upper limit on how wealthy you could get. The fact that we have wealth levels that are much, much bigger than income. You know, wealth to income ratios have been rising very much over the last few years. And wealth tends to be part of our economy that's massively undertaxed at the moment. And what we're seeing, I think, particularly with the COVID pandemic, is progressive wealth taxes becoming more and more mainstream, being more seriously considered by policymakers. There's some interesting stuff happening around them in Latin America. And also, I think Spain has put out ideas of implementing some progressive wealth taxes.
Yes, and polling shows that wealth taxes are overwhelmingly popular with voters. If you look at taxing offshore wealth alone, I mean, the estimates, and of course, they have to be estimates, don't they, because of the secrecy levels involved. The estimates say it's up to $32 trillion being held offshore. So there's a huge need for a global asset registry and for transparency in tax havens to facilitate fair taxation. And your second proposal reckons just from taxing capital income from offshore private wealth could raise $125 billion a year.
Exactly. Yeah. I think really, even if we didn't implement a new wealth tax and we were able to tax the income, just the income that people earn from their offshore wealth, it would still be within the hundreds of billions of dollars that are evaded or that could be raised if this stuff was brought onshore. It does tend to be the richest people that hide their wealth offshore. Something like two-fifths of the wealthiest 0.01% in Colombia evade taxes, with these people kind of roughly concealing around a third of their wealth offshore. So it's very much pervasive, and it has to be part of any platform to implement some kind of globally coordinated wealth tax system.
Okay,
she's going to run down some more of the bullet points on our interview. That was from the TaxCast, obviously from the UK. That's Naomi Fowler, F-O-W-L-E-R. And interviewing Ben Tippett, T-I-P-P-E-T. He's actually with this Amsterdam unit called TNI, Transnational Institute, TNI.org on the web. Just ran into something else they did on corporate power, an audio interview that looks pretty neat too. Thanks for listening. Opinions you hear are those of the speakers, not necessarily shared by others at the station. I'm getting my second dose of Moderna in about 40 minutes, and I'm a little concerned,
but I will survive. No, I've been reading all this stuff about people very having much reactions. So I plan on laying around watching Europa League football matches. And, well, of course, I listen to you guys. And thanks again for listening. Help support community media.
At WEFT is brought to you in part by Minuteman Press. For a few special invitations printed or thousands of full-color flyers, Minuteman Press can help get it done on time and in budget. They offer an extensive line of products as well as design services. Due to COVID-19, please contact Minuteman Press for safe ordering, pickup, and delivery options. Phone 217-355-0550. They are located at 905 South Neal Street in Champaign.